There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host. On today's program, it's going to be a big news wrap-up. It's the dog days of summer. Usually kind of a dead time for goings-on in the Senate and at the FCC, but it's an unusually lively August right now. So we'll be catching up with net neutrality and revision to telecom rules. We'll also be catching up with ownership and other issues of importance to those of us who think it's important to know what's going to happen to our telecommunications and media. The Senate telecommunications bill that I've been talking about pretty much every week here is not likely to see any action until September now. This bill would create a national cable franchise and is no closer to a vote than it has been all summer. One factor holding up the bill is Democrat threats of a hold or a filibuster. Majority Leader Bill Frist won't let the bill come down to the floor for a vote unless the bill's chief sponsor, Commerce Committee Chair Ted Stevens, can rustle up the 60 votes necessary to force a vote. But another factor holding up the bill has turned out to be members of the Republican Party who are up for re-election this November who are reluctant to sign on, fearing voter reprisals. The key controversy over the bill is the fact that while it is a massive giveaway to the nation's largest telephone companies by easing their entry into the cable TV market, it contains no provisions to ensure the telcos don't use their growing power to limit, filter, or slow down access to multimedia content they don't have a hand in. While the big telcos have been spending millions this summer trying to give the appearance that a grassroots coalition of their customers is joining them in opposition to network neutrality, vulnerable senators like Pennsylvania's Rick Santorum know the truth that the real grassroots voting power supports guaranteed free speech on the internet. Other Republican senators who reportedly have cold feet include Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island, Mike DeWine of Ohio, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, and Jim Talent of Missouri. As a result of Senate Republicans' reticence to rally behind the telecom bill, it remains in limbo until the Senate reconvenes after Labor Day. But there's still no indication that the legislation is any more likely to see a vote before Election Day. Such a delay could give Stevens an opportunity to push for a vote in a post-election lame duck session, but that's a gamble. If the Republicans retain at least a 60-seat majority, then the telecom bill might have a chance, provided party unity prevails. But if the Democrats make gains in the Senate, then that would probably spell death for the bill in its current form. Still, Senator Stevens is not giving up on his agenda for creating the national franchise, patronizing AT&T and Verizon, and killing network neutrality. Instead, he's gone postal, putting together a direct mail campaign, sending a pamphlet to fellow senators to support his bill and arguing against network neutrality. It's an unusual move for a senator to take, especially unusual for the chair of a major committee. This leads Alex Curtis, a blogger for the think tank Public Knowledge, to ask questions like, has a congressional committee itself, not a lobbyist or public interest group, ever advocated for a piece of legislation with a promotional brochure? Is this a proper role of a committee? And what would members of the committee who didn't vote for the legislation have to say about it? While Stevens, also known as the author of the series of Tubes Theory of the Internet, is looking increasingly desperate, A more cynical view of the debate is being heard from the Brookings Institution. Brookings congressional scholar Thomas Mann tells Forbes magazine, quote, "Telecom reform has been a cash cow for members of Congress. The battles go on for years, and the fundraising requests never stop." That leads Forbes to posit that perhaps the senators aren't actually so interested in voting on this bill if they can keep bringing in money from the likes of AT&T. And indeed, AT&T has led the effort to defeat network neutrality and has also been the biggest corporate donor to Republicans in this year's election cycle, investing $1.1 million. So yes, money still does buy something in Washington, but representatives campaigning for re-election know that it still takes voters. But the question remains, who wants to be on record for damaging free speech on the internet right before Election Day? Well, maybe there's an answer to this question here.
Get some backup singers. Net neutrality. Do-do-do. Net neutrality. Net neutrality. I really need to get some backup singers.
Streaming some going on the internet.
Watching the girl at hot dog on a stick make lemonade.
Internet started with a concept of local-to-local connections across the country. Local-to-local, a new kind of long distance.
No, it is not!
A service that's immune to distance and is there for the consumer.
I want to see the girl in the tri-colored funny hat doing a funny motion.
But when we take indicate that anyone that wants to use this system for massive commercial purposes.
Hello! They're trying to make you watch Robin Williams' cousin make bacon juice, and he's just as hairy as Robin Williams, but not even as funny as Robin Williams is not. He's just squeezing bacon into a cup, and they're like, hey, that's the same as watching the hot dog on a stick girl. No, it is not!
This service is now going to go through the internet, and what you do is you just go to a place on the internet, and you order your movie, and guess what? You can order 10 of them, and to deliver to you, and this delivery charge is free, right? 10 movies streaming across that internet, and what happens to your own personal internet? I just the other day got internet was sent by my staff at 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. I got it yesterday.
The internet, that was his whole goal. And then the big internet service providers are like, well, we can make a fake version of that. And you're like, can't I just do that? And they're like, well, only if those people give us some fried cheese. And everybody's like, but it's already there. Can I just see it?
And here we have this one situation where enormous entities want to use the internet for their purpose to save money for doing what they're doing now. They use the delivery services. They deliver in other ways, but they want to deliver vast amounts of information over the internet.
And they're like, not while we have this big wall that's built out of the shredded First Amendment, and they hold it together with glue reeds.
And that was Senator Ted Stevens, chair of the Commerce Committee, versus the ninja from AskAninja.com. That's put together by DJ Aprigliano. You'll find that at aprigliano.blogspot.com. And now, unfortunately, back to the news here on Media Geek. 84 members of the House, all Democrats, save for one Republican, sent a letter to FCC Chairman Kevin Martin calling on the commission to conduct its review of media ownership rules in an open fashion. As I reported last week, Martin plans to hold a half dozen public hearings on the issue. It still isn't known, though, if any of the FCC's research reports or any of the proposed changes will be made available before the hearings or even before the comment deadline of September 22nd. In their August 1st letter, the lawmakers told Martin that the FCC's announced plans are not enough and further demanded that, quote, the FCC must also fully disclose all proposed rule changes and give the American people a fair chance to review and weigh in on any such proposal. Such activity should include, at the very least, another extended comment period with second visits to all of the markets targeted by the current town hall meetings, end quote. The FCC's last attempt at revising media ownership rules failed when it was struck down by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in 2004. The new rules would have greatly loosened ownership restrictions on the ownership of television stations and eliminated the cross-ownership ban that prevents most newspapers and TV stations in the same market from being co-owned. The commission's approach to conducting that process was widely criticized by interest groups across the political spectrum for its closed nature and then-Chairman Michael Powell's indifference to public input. That's why public interest groups and the FCC's two Democratic commissioners are keeping up pressure on Martin and the other two Republicans on the commission to make this proceeding as open and public as possible. If public comments to the FCC are any indication, then it's fair to say there's very little public support for loosening media ownership rules. More and more people are understanding the connections between ownership and the content and news they see and don't see in their newspapers and on their TVs. For more on the issue, including easy instructions for submitting your comments to the FCC, look to the MediaGeek website at MediaGeek.net. You can also see the that brochure I mentioned before that Ted Stevens has been sending out to his fellow congresspeople. And also on the media ownership issue, look to StopBigMedia.com. And in a related story, it turns out that the White House has been taking a rather unique view of big media. In order to inflate the Bush administration's record on helping small companies, it's been classifying such media giants as the New York Times, Bloomberg, and USA Today as small businesses. According to an Associated Press report, the New York Times received two General Services Administration contracts totaling $10,875 that were reported as contracts to small businesses. But Times spokeswoman Abby Serfos says that her company did not attempt to portray itself as a small business. Even the Associated Press was cited by the government as receiving five small business contracts valued at $31,600. The government is required to spend 23% of roughly $314 billion in contracts with small businesses. But an investigation by House Democrats found that the actual amount spent was closer to 22% because contracts worth approximately $12 billion went to large companies erroneously classified as small businesses. And you are listening to Media Geek. My name is Paul Riesenel. I'm your host. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. Today, really more the latter, we're critically examining the news of our media environment today, catching up on what's going on. And I bring this to you on the Media Geek radio show on a regular basis, sometimes as headlines at the start of the show, sometimes as a larger component of the program, because I think it's very important for us to understand what's going on. News of the type that I'm bringing you about media legislation, about what's going on with various media companies, does often get covered in places like newspapers, but it's put into the business section because it's not thought of as something that's important to democracy, as important to the free flow of information so that we can make good, reasonable, informed judgments about how we want our government to behave, to represent us, how we want our lives to go down. It's treated like a business. That's if the only reason for the media and for this very media legislation to exist is for profit making and profit losing. It's not covered there on the politics page, on the news page, or elsewhere in the newspaper, except maybe sometimes it shows up in the entertainment section. And you really don't hear about most of this stuff on the radio or on television. And that's why I bring it here, to put it in this new context, so that we can all kind of have a sense of what's going on, and maybe also start to see how it's important that we speak up, and we let our legislators know what we would like, we let the FCC know what we'd like, and we can also better make decisions about how we can make our own media and contribute our own opinions, our own ideas, and our own stories, be it online, radio, or television. It's all wrapped up together. And I think definitely the internet, as a means for communication, has helped people learn more about all these things and help the activists and the scholars and the researchers and the media makers in this arena communicate better with each other to help it all move forward. And going into this year in the media ownership review that I just mentioned before, I think it's going to be very important for the FCC to hear what people think. Because regardless of what you think about the political process, regardless of what you think about the FCC, gains can be made. And at the very least, such as what happened in 2002 and 2003, you can force the FCC into having to ignore public opinion in order to feed the troughs of the large media companies and have to show itself for that. And it's arguable that that's why Michael Powell is no longer chair of the FCC, that his bull in the China shop tendencies is what made it easy to get rid of him from the FCC. So this is the stuff I think we need to know about, and that's why I do it here. Leading into more media ownership stuff. Speaking of the big media, satellite TV rivals Dish Network and DirecTV are ganging together to buy up as much spectrum as they can in an upcoming FCC auction on August 9th. Teaming up under the name Wireless DBS LLC, the companies are looking to win the right to use advanced wireless services spectrum, which they could then use to enhance their ability to offer broadband audio and video content to consumers. It looks like the two satellite TV providers, normally competitors, are worried about the threat of broadband video services that are being rolled out by telephone and cable companies. Also, the telcos and cable operators are looking to offer a bundle of three services, previously different, video, telephone, and internet, all in one package, while satellite can really only offer one. That's video. But this venture to cooperate on buying up spectrum together could be an indicator of something bigger looming in the satellite TV market, a possible merger between DirecTV and Dish Network. Together, the two companies have 27 million subscribers. On a recent edition of the Charlie Rose Show, media baron Rupert Murdoch, whose news corporation owns a controlling stake in DirecTV, says that he believes such a merger would not be a threat to competition because consumers have much more access to video programming than before. It's a familiar argument being made by big media players across different telecommunications sectors and by the FCC itself. But the rates for telephone, cable, and internet service keep going up, despite the supposed increase in choice and competition for consumers. While neither Dish nor DirecTV are commenting on merger rumors, public interest groups are not likely to take such a move lying down, especially since satellite TV services represent the only competition to cable television in most cities and towns. Of course, after August 9th, we'll probably know more about what the satellite giants are planning. Recently, the FCC released a report saying that the number of high-speed internet connections in the U.S. increased by 33% in 2005. The total number of high-speed lines at the end of 2005 was 50.2 million, of which 43 million served residential users. For the first time, DSL connections increased at a faster rate than cable modems, even though cable internet connections still account for 57.5% of high-speed internet lines compared to 40.8% for DSL. While those numbers may look encouraging, the U.S. still lags behind other industrialized nations with regard to internet connectivity. In 2005, the International Telecommunications Union ranked the U.S. at 16th in the world in broadband internet penetration. But even more important is the difference in the quality and speed of service. The FCC classifies a high-speed internet connection as one that provides at least 200 kilobits per second of data in at least one direction. To put that in perspective, that's about four times the speed of the fastest phone modem connection. It's fast enough to provide FM-quality streaming audio, but barely fast enough to provide decent real-time video. In fact, if your internet connection only provides 200 kilobits per second, it would take you much more than a half hour to download a half-hour TV program from the iTunes Music Store or a similar service. Compare this situation to South Korea, where it's not unusual for residential customers to be able to connect to the internet at 100 megabits per second. That's 500 times the rate which the FCC considers to be high speed. Even in many places in Europe, 24 megabit connections are commonly available. That's one quarter the speed available in Korea, but still nearly 100 times faster than the FCC's minimum. But France Telecom is aiming even higher, announcing a pilot to bring 2.5 gigabit connections to six districts in Paris for just 70 euros a month, which includes free installation and free phone service. The truth is that U.S. internet connections have not grown nearly as quickly as the big telephone companies promised in 1996, when they got all sorts of regulatory concessions from the Congress. Back then, the telcos were predicting 25 megabit connections would be happening now. Yet most of us are lucky to get more than 2 megabits for our $50 to $70 a month. So while most Americans are getting onto the internet at higher speed, most of us still lack a connection fast enough to really take advantage of the ability to share high-speed multimedia content and video. And with their all-out fight against network neutrality, the big telcos aim to keep it that way by creating a two-tiered internet, where the big companies are connected like they were in 2006 Paris, and the rest of us will enjoy speeds straight out of 1996. And this is Media Geek. I'll be back in just a moment.
A lot of talk about this next song. This song is not a rebel song. This song is Sunday, like Sunday. I can't believe the news today. I can't close my eyes and make it go away. How long must we sing this song? How long? Too long. Tonight, we can be as one. Tonight. Broken models under children's feet. Bodies strewn across the goddamn streets. But I won't heed the battle call. It pushed my back up against the wall. Sunday, bloody Sunday. Let's roll. And the battle's just begun. This many lost. Who has won? The trenches dug within our hearts. Mothers, children, brothers, sisters, torn apart. Sunday, bloody Sunday. How long must we sing this song? How long? Too long. Tonight, we can be as one. Tonight. Sunday, bloody Sunday. Let's roll it. Anyone who wants more details on my agenda can find them online. The web address is not very imaginative, but it's easy to remember. Park.com. Wipe the tears from your eyes. Wipe your tears away. Wipe your bloodshot eyes. Sunday, bloody Sunday. Let's roll it. And it's true, not a meme. One fact's fiction and TV reality. And today the millions cry. We eat and drink while tomorrow they die. Sunday, bloody Sunday.
The multi-talented George W. Bush, in his rendition of Sunday, Bloody Sunday, a pretty darn good one, brought to us by RX, who can be found at thepartyparty.com. Once again, that's thepartyparty.com. And you are listening to Media Geek, trying to indulge in a little bit of free collage art there. That's still allowed, still out there, because of the tubes. Finally, this summer, the FCC has received several petitions from the National Association of Broadcasters asking the commission to make subtle but potentially powerful changes to the FM radio band. The most recent request is to limit the reach of tiny unlicensed FM transmitters that are commonly used to send the sound from MP3 players and other portable electronics to car radios. Designed to broadcast with minuscule wattage on unused frequencies, the NAB says that they're still too powerful and might cause problems with stations broadcasting digital HD radio signals on adjacent frequencies. Of course, one might take the opposite argument that HD digital radio is the problem, since it's already been well documented that so-called HD radio, also known as IBOC, causes nasty digital interference with adjacent analog radio stations, often cutting into their geographic reach. The NAB's argument against these microtransmitters sounds a lot like its argument against low-power FM stations. In light of the Senate Commerce Committee's recent vote to restore low-power FM and put more stations on the air, the NAB has revived its campaign to convince lawmakers that 10 and 100-watt stations pose an enormous interference threat to stations broadcasting with as much as 100,000 watts of power. The argument is even more absurd when applied to these tiny transmitters that broadcast with less than 1/100th of a watt. The FCC's rules governing the use of unlicensed transmitters on the FM broadcast band, known as the Part 15 rules, are very stringent and explicit about limiting the broadcast range of these transmitters. If the rules weren't already so restrictive, then wouldn't we all be hearing way more unlicensed broadcasts from iPods and CD players interfering with our favorite licensed stations? But I do believe that the National Association of Broadcasters are threatened by these transmitters, but not for the reasons they cite. Rather, the use of MP3 players and other portable music devices are slowly eroding their audience, especially amongst young, affluent listeners who can afford to buy these players and who are also advertisers' favorite target audience. The NAB doesn't think you should be listening to MP3s in your car or house. They want you to be tuned into the same 40-some songs played in heavy rotation over and over and over again. Mostly, they want you tuned into fast food and beer commercials. And if they have to neuter the little transmitter you bought at the electronics store to do it, I guess they'll try it. So is it the iTrip that killed the radio star? Next week, I hope to have my pal John Anderson of DIYmedia.net and Free Press's Media Minutes in here, because he has been really keeping up to date on all sorts of FM radio spectrum issues. He's been here to talk about IBOC radio, and you can go see, listen to that archive at radio.mediageek.net. But he's also got the news on a bid by AM radio broadcasters who want to get repeater translator stations, as they're known, on the FM dial to extend their service. And also new information on how Christian broadcasters are reaping a huge financial windfall by trafficking in licenses for these repeater translator stations that otherwise come free from the federal government. So that should be on next week's edition of Media Geek. You can also read about that stuff, all those issues, over at John's website at DIYmedia.net, www.DIYmedia.net. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.